Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we will be talking with Dr. Ira Byock about his book, The Best Care Possible.
You know, Christy, he is the director of palliative medicine at Dartmouth Medical Center and a national, international expert about death and dying, and such an important topic. I think something that all of us could learn a lot by reading his books. I look forward to the conversation.
I do as well. But first, we're going to talk about some research that matters. We've got information about cinnamon challenge.
That sounds like a hard one to say, but
sounds
I hope
delicious.
We'll see. That's right. About exercise and sleep apnea.
About fiber to reduce your stroke risk.
And about exercises to improve our mental capacity as we age. All really important. Let's dive right in here about this cinnamon challenge. What the heck are we talking about, Christy?
What we're talking about is a game that young people and in peer pressure settings sometimes will do, which involves trying to swallow a tablespoon of ground cinnamon in a minute without drinking water. Kind of sounds awful.
It does sound awful. And it sounds like really people are doing this and for what reason? But this research was actually in the journal Pediatrics, a major pediatric young child journal, in which they looked in the last year and found over 200 reports of serious effects that came from these kids doing this cinnamon challenge.
And calls to poison control centers and internet activity related to the cinnamon challenge really peaked in 2012 and have started to decline, thankfully, because there are a number of problems that can come, health problems, from doing this.
Right. You can inhale this into your lungs, and this is not broken down. Cinnamon isn't broken down easily in the lungs at all, and so it's a tremendous irritant. People sneeze, asthma, and in the lungs, it can cause chronic lung damage. So it's not a good idea to be inhaling spices in bulk capacity at all.
Well, we've all probably done some not-so-smart things in our younger years, but to me this raises...
Moi?
I'm looking at you. I'm sure you did something not smart when you were young, but this is one of those things where a child or a teenager may not really think there's harm from cinnamon. And so I think it's worth doctors and parents asking kids and sort of having an awareness that this is one of those things like sniffing glue or other things that kids do that really can cause harm.
And whether it's cinnamon or oregano or basil, I don't think you should be eating a half to a whole tablespoon at any one time of any of these.
Yeah, well, okay. I would agree with you. I like cinnamon, but not that much.
Okay. What about this next one, Christy, around exercise and sleep apnea?
I think this has a little bit of good news for people who have mild sleep apnea. This was a study done in a sleep clinic in Finland and really looking to see what happens to people who have mild sleep apnea if they enter a really regimented weight loss and exercise program over the next several years.
So this was in the Journal of the American Medical Association's journal Internal Medicine. And they looked at 81 people who were overweight or obese who had this mild sleep apnea. And they had this one-year weight loss intervention that you mentioned. And then they followed them up 4 years afterwards to see, well, what happened with their weight and what happened with their sleep apnea? Because sleep apnea is a pretty bad condition if it goes untreated.
Yeah, and the bottom line is that the people who lost some weight over 4 years, so 4 years later, even if they regained a little back, there were still some significant benefits in terms of that sleep apnea. So losing the weight in the early time did have benefit sort of longer term on how that sleep apnea progressed.
And I think this is just one of those incredibly good common sense stories, Christy, that if you're overweight and you're starting to develop problems like sleep apnea, which causes high blood pressure, causes lung problems, causes fatigue, you can prevent many of these earlier on through weight loss.
So let that be a call to action to say, you know what, I really, really need to do something about this weight.
Speaking about call to action, our next research that matters was in the journal Stroke. What do you think the research was on, Christy?
Stroke.
You got it. You must have read it.
I'm a genius. This is about fiber and how much fiber you have in your diet and a link to a lower risk of having a stroke.
And we know that most American men and women actually don't get enough fiber. The average Jewish woman gets about 13 grams of fiber a day, and the average man gets about 17 grams of fiber a day. That's about half of what is usually recommended for both groups. So does that matter? And what can we do about it?
Well, this researchers found as they followed people, I mean, this is 500,000 people, as they pulled the results of eight different studies conducted since 1990 and followed them over time, up to 19 years in some case, that the risk of suffering a first-time stroke fell by 7% for every 7-gram increase in dietary fiber that people reported eating each day. So you can translate that into real language. But
right, 1% for every 1-gram increase, potentially.
Potentially.
So you want to go out and get a fiber bar or fiber cereal and get 7 grams of fiber, you're going to have a pretty significant potential. And we say potential. Why do we say potential?
Well, because we can't prove that you going out and eating more fiber is necessarily going to be the thing that decreases your risk of stroke. But as a whole, those people who ate the most fiber are reported to eat it the most on a daily basis over time had the lowest chance of stroke.
And because fiber tends to be lower calorie, we link to our last research article that we just had, Christy, they'll have less of the sleep apnea as well.
Mm-hmm.
What about our very final research that matters?
Okay, so everyone wants to know, how can I decrease my risk of dementia and how can I ward off any progression of this? And so this was a study and a researcher at the University of Toronto to pool all the information we have about medications and exercise and mental training to see what do we actually know can help our patients.
This was in the Canadian Medical Association Journal, and what they looked at, which was initially kind of depressing, which is that most of the medications, including hormone therapy, vitamins, and supplements, including ginkgo and omega-3 acids, really did not have any benefit in helping elderly preserve mental function and preventing dementia.
So the medications didn't have a big benefit. They looked at physical activity.
That's got to work, right?
Well, you'd hope. And it might, but the studies have mixed results. So not a lot of strong evidence there.
It didn't help memory, but the exercise seemed to have this executive function, overall well-being. It was good for people. Certainly didn't hurt them.
Absolutely. But the mental training, when there were only 3 studies, but pretty decent size studies, showed some promise.
Well, and one of them was where people went through 10-hour-long training sessions that taught them how to remember things like word list. And 2 years later, those who went through that performed better on mental exercises than those who did not participate.
And so the tasks that really focused on memory helped people with memory. Those that focused on reasoning interventions or speed of reasoning helped with those particular things, suggesting that you really have some benefit on these particular areas. But, I mean, it's 10 one-hour sessions that led to the benefit, so that has some elements, I think, for cost and time.
Do you ever have a hard time remembering names, Christy?
All the time.
I think a lot of people do. And I remember the old Carnegie Method ways of remembering names. And you could teach people these mental health games, in this case, for remembering names. And
it was
things
like
listening carefully, which we could practice, repeating someone's name, using visual cues, making an association between the way someone looks and something that you can remember easily, write it down, and lastly, come up with little games to make it all fun.
Let's ask our smart health sciences librarians to put a link about that onto our blog. That would help our listeners.
Well, that'll conclude our research that matters. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Ira Byock about his new book. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with the Director of Palliative Medicine at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center and Professor at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth, Dr. Ira Byock, about his new book, The Best Care Possible.
Thank you for being with us, Dr. Byock.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, Dr. Byock, we were really interested in this idea about a good death and this whole concept, and then along comes your book, The Best Care Possible. Tell us how you became interested in end-of-life care, palliative care, death and dying.
Well, first, thanks for having me. I initially trained as a family physician. And during my residency training in Fresno, California, I became involved in starting a fledgling hospice program. It's a long story, but basically I was so proud of the care that we gave, but there seemed to be this sort of blind spot at the very end of life where people were somehow left to fend for themselves or figure out, you know, how to navigate the health system and frankly, how to support one another through the end of life. And I saw tragic things happen. Saw people, you know, I remember meeting people in the emergency department when I was rotating through the ER and who'd waited, you know, 5 or 6 hours to get their Tylenol with codeine refilled. And the name on the bottle was one of my residency colleagues who was now doing OB, I happen to know. Or I'd meet somebody in the surgery C clinic who had a liver full of cancer down to her iliac crest, and she didn't know who her doctor was. She just kept coming to the clinic when she could, and there was nobody to follow her at home. I saw people admitted with bowel obstructions when you took a history, it was clearly just constipation that had been going on for 10 days. So with all of this, we developed a little hospice program that just met the problems and dealt with some of these crises. What sucked me into this field, frankly, was finding out that when we dealt with the problems, not uncommonly, this time of life had remarkable value for the person who was seriously ill and dying, and for their loved ones and for their families. And I wasn't prepared for that. I remember a guy called Mr. Rodriguez who was in the hospital, had been admitted for abdominal pain and jaundice, and we had a liver full of tumor. Knew that he was within, you know, a few days to a week or so of death because we'd had the talk. And I saw him one day on rounds in the morning, and I said, "Mr. Rodriguez, how are you doing today?" He looked me in the eyes and said, "I'm well, doctor. How are you?" And I heard that, and you know, the first time or two I heard that, I thought, well, that's really interesting. But I kind of pushed it off. Well, you know, it's the morphine, or maybe it's the steroids we have him on. Sure,
or the distance that you have from him that we're told.
But after a while, I began to realize that maybe people were trying to teach me something.
Mm-hmm.
And I've come to realize that there is something about the potential for well-being during this time of life, both for individuals and for families.
So what does it mean? You talk a lot, and we will be talking more today, I hope, about helping people die well and this value of a good death. Tell us and help us, our listeners, understand, what is a good death compared with a bad one?
I actually prefer the phrase dying well. I think that the phrase good death sort of conflates death, which is beyond life, a lifeless, you know, state, with dying, which is part of living. And I chose the phrase dying well. Actually, it's the name of my first book, Because when you hear that phrase, while initially people think the word well is an adverb, sort of, you know, defining the process or experience of dying, and it can, obviously, it's grammatically correct, it is, but it's more provocative to hear that word well as an adjective, defining the person who is dying. Can a person die well? From my perspective, you know, as a family doc who's now a palliative care doc, the answer is obviously yes. We're more than our bodies, and I know many people who have had a sense of well-being. You know, what do I mean by that? Well, usually defined on their terms, a sense that they're reasonably comfortable. They have a sense that there's nothing critically important left undone. They have, you know, mended, tended, or nurtured the relationships with people that they love and who love them. They've done some of the legacy work that, you know, is really just natural when somebody aren't in pain, you know, when people aren't in pain and they're not too worried about their families, they're not in too much distress, they naturally look back and reflect on their lives. So for me, dying well is this sense of, despite not wanting to die, despite the sadness and often tragedy that an impending death represents, when people can say that they have this concurrently, have this sense of well-being.
Well,
that for me is the highest clinical outcome I can imagine.
Hmm. Well, you know, you point out in your book statistics that I think Christy and I as practicing family docs know, but it's still pretty startling, which is that 30% of deaths occur for people, you know, older people in nursing homes, and up to 50% in the hospital. How does dying well differ for this large number who maybe three generations ago probably didn't die in nursing homes and hospitals?
I think it's harder. I, you know, frankly, we've made dying harder than it's ever been in human history. People are actually sicker as they die than any time in human history. That sounds odd the first time you hear it, but in fact, you know, we've invented chronic illness in the latter part of the 20th century. People used to die very quickly of flash pulmonary edema, the very first episode of, you know, pulmonary edema. They used to die of heart attacks far more commonly than they do now. Cancer was a subacute illness lasting 2 or 3 weeks for most people. Nowadays, things like congestive heart failure and pulmonary edema are bumps in the road. We all know so many people who are living quite well for most of their course of their illnesses. But we've yet to make even one person immortal.
So can you die well in nursing homes and in hospitals?
Yes, you can. Great question. Absolutely. But we aren't supporting it today. I know it's possible because of the work that I and people in my field have done. You know, in our acute care hospital, I have 15 clinicians who are serving patients and families who are living with chronic or serious illnesses. Including in the ICU, we have a separate ICU palliative care team that is attending to people's physical, emotional, social, and even spiritual well-being in the course of an acute life-threatening illness.
So
you can do this, but it takes a reshaped health system. And frankly, the point I make in my book is that while much better health services are available and needed to help people to die well in this environment. Frankly, it's not only that that's needed. We also need family and community support. We need to rethink the way we approach this phase of human life.
Well, what are the main elements in our system and in our politics, law, religion that get in the way of dying well?
You know, first of all, we all want to be alive. Life is precious. And all of us go into medicine, obviously, to save and prolong and preserve and frankly, celebrate life. The problem is that we all die sometime. Unfortunately, the health system in the United States is a disease treatment system, and it really focuses solely on diagnosis and treatment of disease. That's not a bad thing entirely. We need the best diagnostics and treatments, but it's not the whole thing.
Dr. Bayak, I want to just take a quick pause here because we're going to need to take a short break, but we must hear what's your prescription for reforming the health system and helping all of us, doctors and patients, come together. So we're going to take a short break. We're going to be right back talking with Dr. Ira Bach about his new book, The Best Care Possible. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with the Director of Palliative Medicine at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center and Professor at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth, Dr. Ira Bach, about his book, the newest book, The Best Care Possible. And before the break, we were talking about some of the barriers being the focus on diagnosis and treatment and maybe systems that get in the way of thinking about the whole person needing to transform the system. What, Adam asked the question, what is your prescription for this problem?
You know, it's going to seem simplistic, but it's really returning and refocusing all of our health services on the person of the patient. Through nobody's ill intention, American healthcare has become a disease treatment system rather than a whole person healthcare system that we all seek. And what I've learned through now almost 35 years of practice is that the very nature of serious illness is only partly medical. Fundamentally, illness is personal for both the person who's ill and their family. And if we simply sort of keep saying that and looking at the ramifications of that, things begin to change. We need to refocus that, you know, the corrective is really defining quality as existing, as comprising the best diagnostics and treatments that are applied in a highly personalized way, consistent with the values, preferences, and priorities of each person. That's what, you know, these days goes by the term shared decision making. Really and truly, the core skills of palliative medicine these days is not symptom management, though we do that well, and pain management, and all of the highly technical, you know, medication conversions and things that we're, I think, best known for. We do all that, but the core skill is shared decision making, and that's changed a lot over the years. You know, when I was growing up, I graduated my residency in 1981. When I was growing up in the 1960s, shared decision making happened when the doctor shared his decisions with you. Right? That's the way it was when I was a boy. In fact, these days we recognize that patients are already expert in their values, preferences, and priorities, informed by their personal history and family history and their culture and often their religion and, you know, all of that. And we are hopefully expert in the diagnostics and therapeutics, the science and technology of medicine. Together, in a shared way, we apply that's the science and technology in a highly personal way. And in doing so, in people with cancer or heart failure or pulmonary fibrosis or ALS, whatever it is, in so doing, we develop a highly personalized plan of care that represents the best care we can possibly provide to each individual and family.
Well, this sounds like family medicine. This
exactly
sounds like the essence of family medicine.
Isn't it exactly family medicine? And unfortunately, these days, you know, we need a team to provide this level of care for people, particularly people who have chronic or progressive and life-threatening illnesses. I used to be offended because when I first realized that there were social workers doing care coordination, I thought, well, that's my job as a family doc. Mm-hmm. Well, but these days, you know, you'd see one or two patients a day if you were doing it all.
We're talking with Dr. Ira Bach about his new book, The Best Care Possible. And Dr. Bach, you know, you are a physician and obviously a national expert in palliative care, but you also have your own emotions. and these relationships. And I wonder, you mentioned briefly in your book that this attachment that we form with patients, and when you're providing palliative care, do these emotions ever get in the way of providing care? Or what happens when a patient has these advanced directives that you are talking about, patients making their decisions known, and you have a different way of understanding what the best care is possible? What do you do with all this kind of these emotions going right in all directions?
One of my key principles, sort of the self-counseling tool, the mantra, if you will, that I play in my head a lot and I teach to residents and fellows is that we're just here to serve. You know, I'm only here to serve. And I'm really strict about helping people through this illness and making decisions consistent with their values, preferences, and priorities. It sounds like a Boy Scout saying this, but I really believe it's true. It's not my life, it's their life, and I'm here to serve them. So within the bounds of ethical practice, I'm there, I help. When I disagree with a decision that a patient or family is making, I'll make my case gently, firmly, often, given my recommendations, but really and truly honor what they decide to do.
So let me ask a question.
That in and of itself gives me satisfaction. I really do believe that quality, but at the end of the day, is the care we're providing consistent with their values, preferences, and priorities?
So let me ask a question. I had a family member, and this sounds like very familiar to a lot of people would say, I had a family member who said when they had their diagnosis of pancreatic cancer, I just want to be comfortable. But we had lots of other family members who had very different ideas about treatment and aggressiveness and believing that being comfortable wasn't necessarily the biggest priority compared to trying to cure and extend life. What advice do you have for this complicated web? And here I am, even a physician of a family member, to help us navigate this, what you define, I think very appropriately, as patient choice.
Right. When one person gets a diagnosis, a family gets the illness. And as family physicians, we know that. One of the tenets of palliative care is it's the patient with his or her family is our unit of care.
Mm-hmm.
I say all this, Adam, because what I do with it in this situation is listen to every member of the family and help them sort of just facilitate coming to some consensus. But they all need to be heard. They deserve to be heard. They're all reeling with the news of the diagnosis and are trying themselves to struggle through and make adjustments. And in allowing them to be heard, it's often possible to help them kind of refocus on the person who actually has the disease, supporting him or her in whatever decision they ultimately make.
That's a beautiful point. It seems it would be wrong for us to wrap up a conversation about dying well without, and the complexity of this, without mentioning advanced directives and how that may be helpful to value a patient's values and priorities and preferences.
When I introduce the subject of advanced directives these days to patients, I no longer start by saying, you know, this is a way to control what happens to you and your body if you're, you know, unable to speak for yourself. I used to say that. I now say, this is a way to project your caring for your family into a future when they may be left to struggle with decisions about your treatment.
Hmm.
You know, they're going to be left to make these decisions, and you can't stop that. That's what families do. But we can give them clear authority to speak for us so that no ethics committee or, heaven forbid, court needs to get involved.
Hmm.
And we can tell them what we think we would want so that as they make these decisions, they can feel that we're there supporting them, that our families are able then to sort of feel that they're making decisions consistent with what we would have wanted in this circumstance. I try not to write these things or counsel patients not to write them as strict contracts, but rather to just guide families, give them clear authority, and then guide them in the decisions you think you would want in these certain circumstances.
Well, it's been certainly a privilege for us and our listeners to have this opportunity to talk with you and learn from you. We've been talking with Dr. Ira Byock, about his book, The Best Care Possible, and this need to change our system to help people die well. Thank you for taking the time with us.
It's really been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for walking with us. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, send it to Christy or myself at yourhealth@unc.edu. And Christy, we have some house calls today about leg cramps and alcohol.
About feeling your hands and feet are always cold.
About dizziness and your vision.
And about having constant knee pain.
This is a lot of pain, a lot of paining here.
It is.
Well, let's listen to our very first one about leg cramps, which can be very painful.
I'm not a big drinker, but when I do drink, I experience leg cramps the following day. What could this mean?
Well, the first thing that came to my mind is some dehydration. When you drink alcohol, typically that can make your body relatively dehydrated, and that can be a piece of having leg cramps.
And leg cramps are really pretty common. I think a lot more people have them than come to see the doctor about mm-hmm. them, but they sometimes do wake people up at night. And so I think particularly if you're drinking alcohol before you go to bed at night, you know, you might be kind of in this funny kind of sleep pattern. You might be, your legs and body may be in a very uncomfortable position. You may not even be aware of it. So I think there's lots of things that can happen that alcohol impacts on sleep, which can impact also leg cramps.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's not a magic answer to this. I would bring it up to your doctor, of course. But, I mean, one thought is to try to pay attention to what time you're drinking, how much you're drinking, and when that impacts you getting these leg cramps. And it may be that you shouldn't drink as much or earlier in the day.
Have a good glass of water if you're drinking mm-hmm. some alcohol. And then also stretch. Stretch your legs out before you go to bed.
That's a great idea.
2 to 3 minutes, really simple, easy, and cheap.
Okay, let's take our very next house call.
My hands and feet are always cold, but I have no discoloration. My physician says my circulation is fine and I have nothing to worry about. What could this mean?
That is a great question and something that I think is really common, that some people are just wired that way where your feet and hands, and I am one of those people, I'll self-disclose, where my feet and my hands are always a little bit cold.
Well, I hope they're not wired together, but it's the
my body's just made that way.
Well, I'm not sure I was made that way, Christy, but I do know that I went skiing as a kid a fair amount of times, and I was out there at so many times with my toes and my fingers mm-hmm. and my feet were just so purple and blue and cold. And now whenever it's really cold outside, I don't have a lot of feeling in that. So I think you can get acquired what we call Raynaud's or bad circulation. I don't know if I agree with the doctor here who says don't worry about it.
Well, you're going to worry about it if it hurts and it's uncomfortable. There are certain things like checking your thyroid, which can give you some heat or cold intolerance. Thinking about maybe it is a mild Raynaud's kind of syndrome.
Raynaud's.
See if our health sciences librarians would post something up about that. And for that, you really just have to wear extra gloves and pay attention
to sometimes those hand warmers, yes, that mm-hmm. you can put inside your gloves and just kind of keep your hands from getting too cold.
We hope that this is something that's easily addressed, but it may be one of those things that you just sort of have to figure out strategies to prevent yourself from getting so cold.
Let's listen to our next house call about dizziness and vision problems this time. We usually think of dizziness in the inner ear.
I've been experiencing dizziness for the past 2 weeks. I've been to two different doctors and have been diagnosed with vertigo and an inner ear infection. Although the dizziness for the most part has gone away, I do have difficulty with my vision. I almost feel like I've been overserved, but only in terms of my vision. If I'm riding in a car or there is a dip in the sidewalk, I am thrown off balance. What could I be experiencing?
Being overserved. I haven't heard that term before, Christy. I like the term, though.
Oh, I think the term implies drinking too much alcohol, maybe not meaning to, and feeling a little bit woozy, but only in terms of the vision. This is a tricky one, because it could be just sort of some after effects of that vertigo, which is where the room is spinning, kind of dizziness. But that sort of ongoing imbalance, to me, makes me want to rethink, is this really just vertigo, or is there something else going on?
I see Christy getting a little worried here about strokes.
Yep.
And TIAs, or transient ischemic attacks.
Yeah, and I would wonder, or is this some residual thing where maybe you'd had a stroke and it's just this one little tiny spot that's given you these weird symptoms, or some other vision problem? I would say definitely go back and get this readdressed to see what else it could be. It's possible it's just the vertigo getting better, but it sounds a little more worrisome to me.
One of the tips you oftentimes hear that people who are on cruise ships and they get that inner ear disturbance is to look at the horizon, have a fixed point on the horizon. And I wonder if you're in that car, first off, please don't be texting and don't be doing games and the sorts of things, because that really can make you a little nauseous and throw you off. And maybe just be looking straight ahead. Fix that on that point.
And definitely don't drive until this has gotten resolved.
Let's listen to our very last house call.
My father is 87 and has consistent knee pain. His physician has given him cortisone shots, but that does not relieve his pain. He has had one knee replacement before, but thinks that he would not be able to go through another surgery and recovery period at his aging condition. Could you recommend suggestions to relieve this pain?
Oh, that makes me sad, just because if he's not well enough to have another surgery, but still having pain, and just how important it is that he and we, as a community, work with him to make sure that at 87 years old, he's not suffering.
And there are other treatments, but they're not so great. There is the artificial cartilage injections, but I think we've talked on that in the show before, Christy. They're not very good. The herbal medications are not too good, really, for this. And so then you're talking about pain medications, and outside of Tylenol and Advil sort of medicines, those aren't so great.
I know. And the steroid shots are typically aimed to help people with pain a lot of times while kind of warding off having to have a knee replacement. So sometimes that can make a small difference, for a temporary difference, that in conjunction with the anti-inflammatories and Tylenol. But after that, you're right, Adam. You're thinking about sort of those stronger medicines that have a lot of side effects.
Now, we are making an assumption here, which is that this is all coming about from arthritis. And that assumption may not be correct, because if you're having pain all the time and the cortisone injections aren't helping and you've already had a knee replacement, this actually may not be arthritis. It may be something else. And so actually getting reevaluated here, I think, could be a good idea to find out what is the cause of the knee pain, because I've been fooled occasionally.
I mean, this sounds like it's the other knee from the one that had the knee replacement. So chances are it is the same cause, but it could be something different.
Could be a cyst, what's called a Baker's cyst.
It could.
Could be treated easily. We'll find out. Let us know. And we want to thank you all for giving us your house calls and questions today. And if you have a question you'd like us to address on a future show, please send it to Christy and myself at yourhealth@unc.edu, or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, or send us a question through our health app by searching for Your Health, one word, on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes.
We want to thank the staff of WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Ira Byock.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.